I submitted, and with a countenance as expressive as I was able to make it of dejected and despairing constancy, came out of the room. Miss Murdstone's heavy eyebrows followed me to the door. I say her eyebrows rather than her eyes, because they were much more important in her face, and she looked so exactly as she used to look at about that hour of the morning in our parlour at Blunderston, that I could have fancied I had been breaking down in my lessons again, and that the dead weight on my mind was that horrible old spelling-book with oval woodcut, shaped to my youthful fancy like the glasses out of spectacles. When I got to the office, and shutting out old Tiffy and the rest of them with my hands, sat at my desk in my own particular nook, thinking of this earthquake that had taken place so unexpectedly, and in the bitterness of my spirit cursing Jip, I fell into such a state of torment about Dora that I wondered I didn't take up my hat and rush insanely to Norwood. The idea of their frightening her and making her cry, and of my not being there to comfort her, was so excruciating that it impelled me to write a wild letter to Mr. Spenlow, beseeching him not to visit upon her the consequences of my awful destiny. I implored him to spare her gentle nature, not to crush a fragile flower, and addressed him generally, to the best of my remembrance, as if, instead of being her father, he'd been an ogre, or the Dragon of Wantley. This letter I sealed and laid upon his desk before he returned, and when he came in I saw him, through the half-opened door of his room, take it up and read it. He said nothing about it all the morning, but before he went away in the afternoon he called me in and told me that I need not make myself at all uneasy about his daughter's happiness. He had assured her, he said, that it was all nonsense, and he had nothing more to say to her. He believed he was an indulgent father, as indeed he was, and I might spare myself any solicitude on her account. You may make it necessary, if you are foolish or obstinate, Mr. Copperfield, he observed, for me to send my daughter abroad again for a term, but I have a better opinion of you. I hope you will be wiser than that in a few days. As to Miss Murdstone, for I had alluded to her in the letter, I respect that lady's vigilance and feel obliged to her, but she has strict charge to avoid the subject. All I desire, Mr. Copperfield, is that it should be forgotten. All you have got to do, Mr. Copperfield, is to forget it. All. In the note I wrote to Miss Mills, I bitterly quoted this sentiment. All I had to do, I said, with gloomy sarcasm, was to forget Dora. That was all, and what was that? I entreated Miss Mills to see me that evening. If it could not be done with Mr. Mills's sanction and concurrence, I besought a clandestine interview in the back kitchen where the mangle was. I informed her that my reason was tottering on its throne, and only she, Miss Mills, could prevent its being deposed. I signed myself hers, distractedly, and I couldn't help feeling when I read this composition over, before sending it by a porter, that it was something in the style of Mr. Micawber. However, I sent it. That night I repaired to Miss Mills's street, and walked up and down until I was stealthily fetched in by Miss Mills's maid, and taken the area way to the back kitchen. I have since seen reason to believe that there was nothing on earth to prevent my going in at the front door, and being shown up to the drawing-room, except Miss Mills's love of the romantic and mysterious. In the back kitchen I raved as became me. I went there, I suppose, to make a fool of myself, and I'm quite sure I did it. Miss Mills had received a hasty note from Dora, telling her that all was discovered, and saying, "Oh, pray come to me, Julia, do, do." But Miss Mills, mistrusting the acceptability of her presence to the higher powers, had not yet gone, and we were all benighted in the desert of Sahara. Miss Mills had a wonderful flow of words, and liked to pour them out. I couldn't help feeling, though she mingled her tears with mine, that she had a dreadful luxury in our afflictions. She petted them, as I may say, and made the most of them. A deep gulf, she observed, had opened between Dora and me, and love could only span it with its rainbow. Love must suffer in this stern world. It ever had been so, it ever would be so. No matter, Miss Mills remarked, hearts confined by cobwebs would burst at last, and then love was avenged. This was small consolation, but Miss Mills wouldn't encourage fallacious hopes. She made me much more wretched than I was before, and I felt, and told her with the deepest gratitude, that she was indeed a friend. We resolved that she should go to Dora the first thing in the morning, and find some means of assuring her, either by looks or words, of my devotion and misery. We parted overwhelmed with grief, and I think Miss Mills enjoyed herself completely. I confided all to my aunt when I got home, and in spite of all she could say to me, went to bed despairing. I got up despairing, and went out despairing. It was Saturday morning, and I went straight to the Commons. I was surprised, when I came within sight of our office door, to see the ticket-porters standing outside talking together, and some half-dozen stragglers gazing at the windows which were shut up. I quickened my pace, and passing among them, wondering at their looks, went hurriedly in. The clerks were there, but nobody was doing anything. Old Tiffy, for the first time in his life, I should think, was sitting on somebody else's stool and had not hung up his hat.
"This is a dreadful calamity, Mr. Copperfield," said he as I entered.
"What is?" I exclaimed. "What's the matter?"
"Don't you know?" cried Tiffy,
and all the rest of them coming round me.
"No," said I, looking from face to face.
"Mr. Spenlow,"
said Tiffy.
"What about him?"
"Dead."
I thought it was the office reeling, and not I, as one of the clerks caught hold of me. They sat me down in a chair, untied my neckcloth, and brought me some water. I have no idea whether this took any time.
"Dead?" said I.
"He dined in town yesterday and drove down in the phaeton by himself," said Tiffy, "having sent his own groom home by the coach, as he sometimes did, you know.
Well,
the phaeton went home without him. The horses stopped at the stable gate. The man went out with a lantern. Nobody in the carriage."
"Had they run away?"
"They were not hot,"
said Tiffy, putting on his glasses.
"No hotter, I understand, than they would have been going down at the usual pace. The reins were broken, but they'd been dragging on the ground. The house was roused up directly, and three of them went out along the road. They found him a mile off."
"More than a mile off, Mr. Tiffy,"
interposed a junior.
"Was it?" "I believe you're right," said Tiffy. "More than a mile off, not far from the church, lying partly on the roadside and partly on the path upon his face. Whether he fell out in a fit, or got out feeling ill before the fit came, or even whether he was quite dead then, there's no doubt he was quite insensible. No one appears to know. If he breathed, certainly he never spoke. Medical assistance was got as soon as possible, but it was quite useless."
I cannot describe the state of mind into which I was thrown by this intelligence. The shock of such an event happening so suddenly, and happening to one with whom I had been in any respect at variance, the appalling vacancy in the room he'd occupied so lately, where his chair and table seemed to wait for him, and his handwriting of yesterday was like a ghost, the indefinable impossibility of separating him from the place, and feeling when the door opened as if he might come in, the lazy hush and rest there was in the office, and the insatiable relish with which our people talked about it, and other people came in and out all day and gorged themselves with the subject, this is easily intelligible to anyone. What I cannot describe is how, in the innermost recesses of my own heart, I had a lurking jealousy even of death. How I felt as if its might would push me from my ground in Dora's thoughts. How I was, in a grudging way I have no words for, envious of her grief. How it made me restless to think of her weeping to others or being consoled by others. How I had a grasping, avaricious wish to shut out everybody from her but myself,
and to be all in all to her at that unseasonable time of all times. In the trouble of this state of mind, not exclusively my own, I hope, but known to others, I went down to Norwood that night, and finding from one of the servants, when I made my inquiries at the door, that Miss Mills was there, got my aunt to direct a letter to her, which I wrote. I deplored the untimely death of Mr. Spenlow most sincerely, and shed tears in doing so. I entreated her to tell Dora, if Dora were in a state to hear it, that he had spoken to me with the utmost kindness and consideration, and had coupled nothing but tenderness, not a single hasty or reproachful word, with her name. I know I did this selfishly, to have my name brought before her, but I tried to believe it was an act of justice to his memory. Perhaps I did believe it. My aunt received a few lines next day in reply, addressed outside to her, within to me. Dora was overcome by grief, and when her friend had asked her should she send her love to me, had only cried, as she was always crying, "Oh, dear Papa, oh, poor Papa." But she'd not said no, and that I made the most of. A few days afterwards, Mr. Jorkins, who had been at Norwood since the occurrence, came to the office. He and Tiffy were closeted together for some few moments, and then Tiffy looked out at the door and beckoned me in. "Oh," said Mr. Jorkins, "Mr. Tiffy and myself, Mr. Copperfield, are about to examine the desk, the drawers, and other such repositories of the deceased, with the view of sealing up his private papers and searching for a will. There is no trace of any elsewhere. It may be as well for you to assist us, if you please." I had been in agony to obtain some knowledge of the circumstances in which my Dora would be placed, as in whose guardianship and so forth, and this was something towards it. We began the search at once, Mr. Jorkins unlocking the drawers and desks, and we all taking out the papers. The office papers we placed on one side, and the private papers, which were not numerous, on the other. We were very grave, and when we came to a stray seal, or pencil case, or ring, or any little article of that kind which we associated personally with him, we spoke very low. We had sealed up several packets, and were still going on dustily and quietly, when Mr. Jorkins said to us, applying exactly the same words to his late partner as his late partner had applied to him, "Mr. Spenlow was very difficult to move from the beaten track. You know what he was. I am disposed to think he had made no will." "Oh, I know he had," said I. They both stopped and looked at me. "On the very day when I last saw him," said I, "he told me that he had, and that his affairs were long since settled." Mr. Jorkins and old Tiffy shook their heads with one accord. "That looks unpromising," said Tiffy. "Very unpromising," said Mr. Jorkins. "Surely you don't doubt," I began. "My good Mr. Copperfield," said Tiffy, laying his hand upon my arm and shutting up both his eyes as he shook his head, "if you had been in the Commons as long as I have, you would know that there is no subject on which men are so inconsistent and so little to be trusted." "Why, bless my soul, he made that very remark," I replied persistently. "I should call that almost final," observed Tiffy. "My opinion is, no will." It appeared a wonderful thing to me, but it turned out that there was no will. He had never so much as thought of making one, so far as his papers afforded any evidence, for there was no kind of hint, sketch, or memorandum of any testamentary intention whatever. What was scarcely less astonishing to me was that his affairs were in a most disordered state. It was extremely difficult, I heard, to make out what he owed, or what he'd paid, or of what he died possessed. It was considered likely that for years he could have had no clear opinion on these subjects himself. By little and little it came out that, in the competition on all points of appearance and gentility, then running high in the Commons,
He had spent more than his professional income, which was not a very large one, and had reduced his private means, if they ever had been great, which was exceedingly doubtful, to a very low ebb indeed. There was a sale at Norwood of the furniture and lease, and Tiffy told me, little thinking how interested I was in the story, that paying all the just debts of the deceased and deducting his share of outstanding bad and doubtful debts due to the firm, he wouldn't give £1,000 for all the assets remaining. This was at the expiration of about 6 weeks. I had suffered tortures all the time, and thought I really must have laid violent hands upon myself, when Miss Mills still reported to me that my broken-hearted little Dora would say nothing when I was mentioned, but, "Oh, poor Papa, oh, dear Papa." Also, that she had no other relations than two aunts, maiden sisters of Mr. Spenlow, who lived at Putney, and who had not held any other than chance communication with their brother for many years. Not that they never quarrelled, Miss Mills informed me, but that having been on the occasion of Dora's christening invited to tea, when they considered themselves privileged to be invited to dinner, they had expressed their opinion in writing that it was better for the happiness of all parties that they should stay away, since which they had gone their road and their brother had gone his. These two ladies now emerged from their retirement and proposed to take Dora to live at Putney. Dora, clinging to them both and weeping, exclaimed, "Oh, yes, aunts, please take Julia Mills and me and Jip to Putney." So they went very soon after the funeral. How I found time to haunt Putney, I'm sure I don't know. But I contrived by some means or other to prowl about the neighbourhood pretty often. Miss Mills, for the more exact discharge of the duties of friendship, kept a journal, and she used to meet me sometimes on the common and read it, or, if she had not time to do that, lend it to me. How I treasured up the entries, of which I subjoin a sample. Monday, my sweet D still much depressed. Headache, called attention to J as being beautifully sleek. D fondled J. Associations thus awakened opened floodgates of sorrow, rush of grief admitted. Ah, tears, the dewdrops of the heart, J.M. Tuesday, D. weak and nervous, beautiful in pallor. Do we not remark this in Moon likewise, J.M.? D., J.M. and J. took airing in carriage, J. looking out of window and barking violently at dustman, occasioned smile to overspread features of D. Of such slight links is chain of life composed, J.M. Wednesday, D. comparatively cheerful, sang to her as congenial melody evening bells, effect not soothing but reverse, D. inexpressibly affected, found sobbing afterwards in own room, quoted verses respecting self and young gazelle, ineffectually. Also referred to patients on monument. Query, why on monument? J.M. Thursday. D. certainly improved. Better night. Slight tinge of damask revisiting cheek. Resolved to mention name of D.C. Introduced same, cautiously, in course of airing. D. immediately overcome. Oh, dear, dear Julia, oh, I've been a naughty and undutiful child. Soothed and caressed, drew ideal picture of D.C. on verge of tomb. D. again overcome. Oh, what shall I do? Oh, take me somewhere. Much alarmed. Fainting of D. and glass of water from public house. Poetical affinity. Checkered sign on doorpost. Checkered human life. Alas! J.M. Friday, day of incident. Man appears in kitchen with blue bag for ladies' boots left out to heel. Cook replies no such orders. Man argues point. Cook withdraws to inquire, leaving man alone with J. On cook's return, man still argues point, but ultimately goes. J. missing. D. distracted. Information sent to police. Man to be identified by broad nose and legs like balustrades of bridge. Search made in every direction. No J. D, weeping bitterly and inconsolable. Renewed reference to young gazelle. Appropriate, but unavailing. Towards evening, strange boy calls. Brought into parlour, broad nose, but no balustrades. Says he wants a pound and knows a dog. Declines to explain further, though much pressed. Pound, being produced by D, takes cook to little house, where J, alone, tied up to leg of table. Joy of D, who dances round J while he eats his supper. Emboldened by this happy change, mention DC upstairs. D weeps afresh, cries piteously, "Oh, don't. It's so wicked to think of anything but poor Papa." Embraces J and sobs herself to sleep. Must not DC confide himself to the broad pinions of time? J.M. Miss Mills and her journal were my sole consolation at this period. To see her, who had seen Dora but a little while before, to trace the initial letter of Dora's name through her sympathetic pages, to be made more and more miserable by her, were my only comforts. I felt as if I'd been living in a palace of cards which had tumbled down, leaving only Miss Mills and me among the ruins. As if some grim enchanter had drawn a magic circle round the innocent goddess of my heart, which nothing indeed but those same strong pinions, capable of carrying so many people over so much, would enable me to enter.
This ends side one of cassette 18. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
Chapter 39, Wickfield and Heap. My aunt, beginning, I imagine, to be made seriously uncomfortable by my prolonged dejection, made a pretence of being anxious that I should go to Dover to see that all was working well at the cottage which was let, and to conclude an agreement with the same tenant for a longer term of occupation. Janet had been drafted into the service of Mrs. Strong, where I saw her every day. She'd been undecided on leaving Dover whether or no to give the finishing touch to that renunciation of mankind in which she had been educated by marrying a pilot, but she decided against that venture, not so much for the sake of principle, I believe, as because she happened not to like him. Although it required an effort to leave Miss Mills, I fell rather willingly into my aunt's pretence as a means of enabling me to pass a few tranquil hours with Agnes. I consulted the good doctor relative to an absence of 3 days, and the doctor, wishing me to take that relaxation, he wished me to take more, but my energy couldn't bear that, made up my mind to go. As to the Commons, I had no great occasion to be particular about my duties in that quarter. To say the truth, we were getting in no very good odour among the tip-top proctors, and were rapidly sliding down to but a doubtful position. The business had been indifferent under Mr. Jorkins before Mr. Spenlow's time, and although it had been quickened by the infusion of new blood and by the display which Mr. Spenlow made, still it was not established on a sufficiently strong basis to bear, without being shaken, such a blow as the sudden loss of its active manager. It fell off very much. Mr. Jorkins, notwithstanding his reputation in the firm, was an easy-going, incapable sort of man, whose reputation out of doors was not calculated to back it up. I was turned over to him now, and when I saw him take his snuff and let the business go, I regretted my aunt's £1,000 more than ever. But this was not the worst of it. There were a number of hangers-on and outsiders about the Commons who, without being proctors themselves, dabbled in common form business, and got it done by real proctors, who lent their names in consideration of a share in the spoil. And there were a good many of these, too. As our house now wanted business on any terms, we joined this noble band, and threw out lures to the hangers-on and outsiders to bring their business to us. Marriage licenses and small probates were what we all looked for and what paid us best, and the competition for these ran very high indeed. Kidnappers and inveiglers were planted on all the avenues of entrance to the Commons, with instructions to do their utmost to cut off all persons in mourning and all gentlemen with anything bashful in their appearance, and entice them to the offices in which their respective employers were interested, which instructions were so well observed that I myself, before I was known by sight, was twice hustled into the premises of our principal opponent. The conflicting interests of these touting gentlemen, being of a nature to irritate their feelings, personal collisions took place, and the Commons was even scandalized by our own principal inveigler, who had formerly been in the wine trade and afterwards in the sworn brokery line, walking about for some days with a black eye. Any one of these scouts would think nothing of politely assisting an old lady in black out of a vehicle, killing any proctor whom she inquired for, representing his employer as the lawful successor and representative of that proctor, and bearing the old lady off, sometimes greatly affected, to his employer's office. Many captives were brought to me in this way. As to marriage licenses, the competition rose to such a pitch that a shy gentleman in want of one had nothing to do but submit himself to the first inveigler, or be forked for and become the prey of the strongest. One of our clerks, who was an outsider, used, in the height of this contest, to sit with his hat on, that he might be ready to rush out and swear before a surrogate any victim who was brought in. The system of inveigling continues, I believe, to this day. The last time I was in the Commons, a civil, able-bodied person in a white apron pounced out upon me from a doorway and, whispering the word "marriage license" in my ear, was with great difficulty prevented from taking me up in his arms and lifting me into a proctor's. From this digression, let me proceed to Dover. I found everything in a satisfactory state at the cottage, and was enabled to gratify my aunt exceedingly by reporting that the tenant inherited her feud and waged incessant war against donkeys. Having settled the little business I had to transact there, and slept there one night, I walked over to Canterbury early in the morning. It was now winter again, and the fresh, cold, windy day, and the sweeping downland brightened up my hopes a little. Coming into Canterbury, I loitered through the old streets with a sober pleasure that calmed my spirits and eased my heart. There were the old signs, the old names over the shops, the old people serving in them. It appeared so long since I'd been a schoolboy there that I wondered to see the place so little changed, until I reflected how little I was changed myself. Strange to say, that quiet influence, which was inseparable in my mind from Agnes, seemed to pervade even the city where she dwelt. The venerable cathedral towers, and the old jackdaws and rooks whose airy voices made them more attired than perfect silence would have done, the battered gateways once stuck full with statues long thrown down and crumbled away, like the reverential pilgrims who had gazed upon them, the still nooks where the ivied growth of centuries crept over gable ends and ruined walls, the ancient houses, the pastoral landscape of field, orchard, and garden. Everywhere, on everything, I felt the same serener air, the same calm, thoughtful, softening spirit. Arrived at Mr. Wickfield's house, I found in the little turret room on the ground floor, where Uriah Heep had been of old accustomed to sit, Mr. Micawber, plying his pen with great assiduity. He was dressed in a legal-looking suit of black and loomed burly and large in that small office. Mr. Micawber was extremely glad to see me, but a little confused, too. He would have conducted me immediately into the presence of Uriah, but I declined. "I know the house of old, you recollect," said I, "and will find my way upstairs. How do you like the law, Mr. Micawber?" "My dear Copperfield," he replied, "to a man possessed of the higher imaginative powers, the objection to legal studies is the amount of detail which they involve, even in our professional correspondence," said Mr. Micawber, glancing at some letters he was writing. "The mind is not at liberty to soar to any exalted form of expression. Still, it is a great pursuit, a great pursuit." He then told me that he had become the tenant of Uriah Heep's old house, and that Mrs. Micawber would be delighted to receive me once more under her own roof. "It is humble," said Mr. Micawber, "to quote a favourite expression of my friend Heep, but it may prove the stepping-stone to more ambitious domiciliary accommodation."
I asked him whether he had reason so far to be satisfied with his friend Heap's treatment of him. He got up to ascertain if the door were close shut before he replied in a lower voice, "My dear Copperfield, a man who labours under the pressure of pecuniary embarrassments is, with the generality of people, at a disadvantage. That disadvantage is not diminished when that pressure necessitates the drawing of stipendiary emoluments before those emoluments are strictly due and payable. All I can say is that my friend Heap has responded to appeals to which I need not more particularly refer, in a manner calculated to redound equally to the honour of his head and of his heart." "I shouldn't have supposed him to be very free with his money either," I observed. "Pardon me," said Mr. Micawber with an air of constraint. "I speak of my friend Heap as I have experience." "I'm glad your experience is so favourable," I returned. "You are very obliging, my dear Copperfield," said Mr. Micawber, and hummed a tune. "Do you see much of Mr. Wickfield?" I asked, to change the subject. "Not much," said Mr. Micawber slightingly. "Mr. Wickfield is, I dare say, a man of very excellent intentions, but he is, in short, he's obsolete." "I'm afraid his partner seeks to make him so," said I. "My dear Copperfield," returned Mr. Micawber, after some uneasy evolutions on his stool, "allow me to offer a remark. I'm here in a capacity of confidence. I'm here in a position of trust. The discussion of some topics, even with Mrs. Micawber herself, so long the partner of my various vicissitudes, and a woman of a remarkable lucidity of intellect, is, I am led to consider, incompatible with the functions now devolving on me. I would therefore take the liberty of suggesting that in our friendly intercourse, which I trust will never be disturbed, we draw a line. On one side of this line," said Mr. Micawber, representing it on the desk with the office ruler, "is the whole range of the human intellect with a trifling exception. On the other is that exception. That is to say, the affairs of Messrs. Wickfield and Heap, with all belonging and appertaining thereunto. I trust I give no offence to the companion of my youth in submitting this proposition to his cooler judgment." Though I saw an uneasy change in Mr. Micawber, which sat tightly on him, as if his new duties were a misfit, I felt I had no right to be offended. My telling him so appeared to relieve him, and he shook hands with me. "I am charmed, Copperfield," said Mr. Micawber, "let me assure you, with Miss Wickfield. She is a very superior young lady, of very remarkable attractions, graces, and virtues. Upon my honour," said Mr. Micawber, indefinitely kissing his hand and bowing with his genteelest air, "I do homage to Miss Wickfield." "I am glad of that, at least," said I. "If you had not assured us, my dear Copperfield, on the occasion of that agreeable afternoon we had the happiness of passing with you, that D was your favourite letter," said Mr. Micawber, "I should unquestionably have supposed that A had been so." We all have some experience of a feeling that comes over us occasionally of what we are saying and doing having been said and done before in a remote time, of our having been surrounded dim ages ago by the same faces, objects, and circumstances, of our knowing perfectly what will be said next, as if we suddenly remembered it. I never had this mysterious impression more strongly in my life than before he uttered those words. I took my leave of Mr. Micawber for the time, charging him with my best remembrances to all at home. As I left him, resuming his stool and his pen and rolling his head in his stock to get it into easier writing order, I clearly perceived that there was something interposed between him and me since he'd come into his new functions, which prevented our getting at each other as we used to do, and quite altered the character of our intercourse. There was no one in the quaint old drawing-room, though it presented tokens of Mrs. Heap's whereabout. I looked into the room still belonging to Agnes, and saw her sitting by the fire at a pretty old-fashioned desk she had writing. My darkening the light made her look up.
What a pleasure to be the cause of that bright change in her attentive face, and the object of that sweet regard and welcome. "Ah, Agnes," said I when we were sitting together side by side, "I've missed you so much lately." "Indeed," she replied. "Again." "And so soon?" I shook my head. "I don't know how it is, Agnes. I seem to want some faculty of mind that I ought to have. You were so much in the habit of thinking for me in the happy old days here, and I came so naturally to you for counsel and support, that I really think I've missed acquiring it." "And what is it?" said Agnes cheerfully. "I don't know what to call it," I replied. "I think I'm earnest and persevering." "I'm sure of it," said Agnes. "And patient, Agnes?" I inquired with a little hesitation. "Yes," returned Agnes, laughing, "pretty well. And yet, sir, I get so miserable and worried, and am so unsteady and irresolute in my power of assuring myself, that I know I must want, shall I call it, reliance of some kind?" "Call it so, if you will," said Agnes. "Well," I returned, "see here. You come to London, I rely on you, and I have an object and a course at once. I'm driven out of it, I come here, and in a moment I feel an altered person. The circumstances that distressed me are not changed since I came into this room, but an influence comes over me in that minute that alters me. Oh, how much for the better! What is it? What's your secret, Agnes?" Her head was bent down, looking at the fire. "It's the old story," said I. "Don't laugh when I say it was always the same in little things as it is in greater ones. My old troubles were nonsense, and now they're serious. But whenever I have gone from my adopted sister..." Agnes looked up with such a heavenly face and gave me her hand, which I kissed. "Whenever I have not had you, Agnes, to advise and approve in the beginning, I have seemed to go wild and to get into all sorts of difficulty. When I've come to you at last, as I've always done, I've come to peace and happiness. I come home now like a tired traveller, and find such a blessed sense of rest." I felt so deeply what I said, it affected me so sincerely, that my voice failed, and I covered my face with my hands, and broke into tears. I write the truth. Whatever contradictions and inconsistencies there were within me, as there are within so many of us, whatever might have been so different and so much better, whatever I had done, in which I had perversely wandered away from the voice of my own heart, I knew nothing of. I only knew that I was fervently in earnest when I felt the rest and peace of having Agnes near me. In her placid, sisterly manner, with her beaming eyes, with her tender voice, and with that sweet composure which had long ago made the house that held her quite a sacred place to me, she soon won me from this weakness, and led me on to tell her all that had happened since our last meeting. "And there's not another word to tell, Agnes," said I, when I'd made an end of my confidence. "Now my reliance is on you." "But it mustn't be on me, Trotwood," returned Agnes with a pleasant smile. "It must be on someone else." "On Dora?" said I. "Assuredly." "Why, I've not mentioned, Agnes," said I, a little embarrassed, "that Dora is rather difficult to... I wouldn't for the world say to rely upon, because she's the soul of purity and truth, but rather difficult to... I hardly know how to express it, really, Agnes. She's a timid little thing, and easily disturbed and frightened. Some time ago, before her father's death, when I thought it right to mention to her... But I'll tell you, if you will bear with me, how it was. Accordingly, I told Agnes about my declaration of poverty, about the cookery book, the housekeeping accounts, and all the rest of it. "Oh, Trotwood," she remonstrated with a smile, "just your old headlong way. You might have been in earnest in your striving to get on in the world without being so very sudden with a timid, loving, inexperienced girl. Poor Dora! I never heard such sweet forbearing kindness expressed in a voice as she expressed in making this reply. It was as if I had seen her admiringly and tenderly embracing Dora and tacitly reproving me by her considerate protection for my hot haste in fluttering that little heart. It was as if I had seen Dora in all her fascinating artlessness caressing Agnes and thanking her and coaxingly appealing against me and loving me with all her childish innocence. I felt so grateful to Agnes and admired her so. I saw those two together in a bright perspective, such well-associated friends, each adorning the other so much. "What ought I to do then, Agnes?" I inquired after looking at the fire a little while. "What would it be right to do?" "I think," said Agnes, "that the honourable course to take would be to write to those two ladies. Don't you think that any secret course is an unworthy one?"
"Yes,
if you think so," said I. "I'm poorly qualified to judge of such matters," replied Agnes with a modest hesitation. "But I certainly feel... In short, I feel that your being secret and clandestine is not being like yourself." "Like myself in the too high opinion you have of me, Agnes, I'm afraid," said I. "Like yourself in the candour of your nature," she returned, "and therefore I would write to those two ladies. I would relate as plainly and as openly as possible all that has taken place, and I would ask their permission to visit sometimes at their house. Considering that you are young and striving for a place in life, I think it would be well to say that you would readily abide by any conditions they might impose upon you. I would entreat them not to dismiss your request without a reference to Dora, and to discuss it with her when they should think the time suitable." "I wouldn't be too vehement," said Agnes gently, "or propose too much. I would trust to my own fidelity and perseverance, and to Dora." "But if they were to frighten Dora again, Agnes, by speaking to her," said I, "and if Dora were to cry and say nothing about me..." "Is that likely?" inquired Agnes, with the same sweet consideration in her face. "God bless her, she's as easily scared as a bird," said I. "It might be. Or if the two Miss Spenlows, elderly ladies of that sort of odd character sometimes, should not be likely persons to address in that way." "I don't think, Trotwood," returned Agnes, raising her soft eyes to mine, "I would consider that. Perhaps it would be better only to consider whether it is right to do this, and if it is, to do it." I had no longer any doubt on the subject. With a lightened heart, though with a profound sense of the weighty importance of my task, I devoted the whole afternoon to the composition of the draft of this letter, for which great purpose Agnes relinquished her desk to me. But first I went downstairs to see Mr. Wickfield and Uriah Heep. I found Uriah in possession of a new plaster-smelling office, built out in the garden, looking extraordinarily mean in the midst of a quantity of books and papers. He received me in his usual fawning way, and pretended not to have heard of my arrival from Mr. Micawber, a pretence I took the liberty of disbelieving. He accompanied me into Mr. Wickfield's room, which was the shadow of its former self, having been divested of a variety of conveniences for the accommodation of the new partner, and stood before the fire, warming his back and shaving his chin with his bony hand, while Mr. Wickfield and I exchanged greetings. "You stay with us, Trotwood, while you remain in Canterbury?" said Mr. Wickfield, not without a glance at Uriah for his approval. "Is there room for me?" said I. "I'm sure, Master Copperfield, I should say Mister, but the other comes so natural," said Uriah. "I would turn out of your old room with pleasure if it would be agreeable." "No, no," said Mr. Wickfield. "Why should you be inconvenienced? There's another room, there's another room." "Oh, but, you know," returned Uriah with a grin, "I should really be delighted." To cut the matter short, I said I would have the other room or none at all. So it was settled that I should have the other room, and taking my leave of the firm until dinner, I went upstairs again.
I'd hoped to have no other companion than Agnes. But Mrs. Heap had asked permission to bring herself and her knitting near the fire in that room, on pretence of its having an aspect more favourable for rheumatics, as the wind then was, than the drawing-room or dining-parlour, though I could almost have consigned her to the mercies of the wind on the topmost pinnacle of the cathedral without remorse. I made a virtue of necessity and gave her a friendly salutation.
"I'm humbly thankful to you, sir,"
said Mrs. Heap in acknowledgement of my inquiries concerning her health, "but I'm only pretty well. I haven't much to boast of. If I could see my Uriah well settled in life, I couldn't expect much more, I think. How do you think my Uri looking, sir?"
I thought him looking as villainous as ever, but I replied that I saw no change in him.
"Oh, don't you think he's changed?" said Mrs. Heap. "There I must humbly beg leave to differ from you. Don't you see a thinness in him?"
"Not more than usual," I replied.
"Don't you, though?" said Mrs. Heap. "But you don't take notice of him with the mother's eye."
His mother's eye was an evil eye to the rest of the world, I thought, as it met mine, howsoever affectionate to him, and I believe she and her son were devoted to one another. It passed me and went on to Agnes.
"Don't you see a wasting and a wearing in him, Miss Wickfield?"
inquired Mrs. Heap.
"No,"
said Agnes, quietly pursuing the work on which she was engaged. "You're too solicitous about him. He's very well." Mrs. Heap, with a prodigious sniff, resumed her knitting. She never left off or left us for a moment. I'd arrived early in the day, and we still had 3 or 4 hours before dinner, but she sat there, plying her knitting needles as monotonously as an hourglass might have poured out its sands. She sat on one side of the fire, I sat at the desk in front of it. A little beyond me on the other side sat Agnes. Whensoever, slowly pondering over my letter, I lifted up my eyes, and meeting the thoughtful face of Agnes, saw it clear and beam encouragement upon me with its own angelic expression, I was conscious presently of the evil eye passing me and going on to her, and coming back to me again and dropping furtively upon the knitting. What the knitting was, I don't know, not being learned in that art, but it looked like a net. And as she worked away with those Chinese chopsticks of knitting needles, she showed in the firelight, like an ill-looking enchantress, balked as yet by the radiant goodness opposite, but getting ready for a cast of her net by and by. At dinner she maintained her watch with the same unwinking eyes. After dinner, her son took his turn. And when Mr. Wickfield himself and I were left alone together, leered at me, and writhed until I could hardly bear it. In the drawing-room there was the mother, knitting and watching again. All the time that Agnes sang and played, the mother sat at the piano. Once she asked for a particular ballad, which she said her Uri, who was yawning in a great chair, doted on. And at intervals she looked round at him and reported to Agnes that he was in raptures with the music. But she hardly ever spoke. I question if she ever did, without making some mention of him. It was evident to me that this was the duty assigned to her. This lasted until bedtime. To have seen the mother and son, like two great bats hanging over the whole house and darkening it with their ugly forms, made me so uncomfortable that I would rather have remained downstairs knitting and all than gone to bed. I hardly got any sleep. Next day the knitting and watching began again and lasted all day. I had not an opportunity of speaking to Agnes for 10 minutes. I could barely show her my letter. I proposed to her to walk out with me, but Mrs. Heap repeatedly complaining that she was worse, Agnes charitably remained within to bear her company. Towards the twilight I went out by myself, musing on what I ought to do, and whether I was justified in withholding from Agnes any longer what Uriah Heap had told me in London, for that began to trouble me again very much. I hadn't walked far enough to be quite clear of the town upon the Ramsgate Road, where there was a good path, when I was hailed through the dusk by somebody behind me.
The shambling figure and the scanty greatcoat were not to be mistaken. I stopped, and Uriah Heep came up. "Well," said I.
"How fast you walk," said he. "My legs are pretty long, but you've given him quite a job."
"Where are you going?" said I.
"I'm coming with you, Master Copperfield, if you'll allow me the pleasure of a walk with an old acquaintance."
Saying this with a jerk of his body, which might have been either propitiatory or derisive, he fell into step beside me. "Uriah," said I, as civilly as I could after a silence.
"Master Copperfield," said Uriah,
"to tell you the truth, at which you will not be offended, I came out to walk alone because I've had so much company." He looked at me sideways and said with his hardest grin,
"You mean Mother?"
"Why, yes, I do," said I.
"Ah, but, you know, we're so very humble," he returned,
"and having such a knowledge of our own humbleness, we must really take care that we're not pushed to the wall by them as isn't humble. All stratagems are fair in love, sir." Raising his great hands until they touched his chin, he rubbed them softly and softly chuckled, looking as like a malevolent baboon, I thought, as anything human could look.
"You see," he said, still hugging himself in that unpleasant way and shaking his head at me, "you're quite a dangerous rival, Master Copperfield. You always was, you know."
"Do you set a watch upon Miss Wickfield and make her home no home because of me?" said I.
"Oh, Master Copperfield, those are very harsh words," he replied.
"Put my meaning into any words you like," said I. "You know what it is, Uriah, as well as I do."
"Oh, no, you must put it into words," he said. "Oh, really, I couldn't myself."
"Do you suppose," said I, constraining myself to be very temperate and quiet with him on account of Agnes, "that I regard Miss Wickfield otherwise than as a very dear sister?"
"Well, Master Copperfield," he replied, "you perceive I'm not bound to answer that question. You may not, you know, but then, you see, you may."
Anything to equal the low cunning of his visage and of his shadowless eyes without the ghost of an eyelash I never saw. "Come then," said I, "for the sake of Miss Wickfield."
"My Agnes,"
he exclaimed, with a sickly, angular contortion of himself. "Would you be so good as to call her Agnes, Master Copperfield?" "For the sake of Agnes Wickfield, heaven bless her."
"Thank you for that blessing, Master Copperfield,"
he interposed. "I will tell you what I should, under any other circumstances, as soon have thought of telling to Jack Ketch."
"To whom, sir?"
said Uriah, stretching out his neck and shading his ear with his hand. "To the hangman," I returned, "the most unlikely person I could think of," though his own face had suggested the allusion quite as a natural sequence. "I am engaged to another young lady. I hope that contents you."
"Upon your soul?"
said Uriah. I was about indignantly to give my assertion the confirmation he required, when he caught hold of my hand and gave it a squeeze.
"Oh, Master Copperfield," he said, "if you had only had the condescension to return my confidence when I poured out the fullness of my heart, the night I put you so much out of the way by sleeping before your sitting-room fire, I never should have doubted you. As it is, I'm sure I'll take off Mother directly, and only too happy. I know you'll excuse the precautions of affection, won't you? What a pity, Master Copperfield, that you didn't condescend to return my confidence. I'm sure I gave you every opportunity, but you never have condescended to me as much as I could have wished. I know you've never liked me as I have liked you."
All this time he was squeezing my hand with his damp, fishy fingers, while I made every effort I decently could to get it away. But I was quite unsuccessful. He drew it under the sleeve of his mulberry-coloured greatcoat, and I walked on almost by compulsion, arm in arm with him.
"Shall we turn?"
said Uriah, by and by wheeling me face about towards the town, on which the early moon was now shining, silvering the distant windows. "Before we leave the subject, you ought to understand," said I, breaking a pretty long silence, "that I believe Agnes Wickfield to be as far above you and as far removed from all your aspirations as that moon herself."
"Peaceful, ain't she?"
said Uriah.
"Very.
Now confess, Master Copperfield, that you haven't liked me quite as I've liked you. All along you thought me too humble. Now I shouldn't wonder."
"I am not fond of professions of humility," I returned, "or professions of anything else."
"There now," said Uriah, looking flabby and lead-coloured in the moonlight.
"Didn't I know it?
But how little you think of the rightful humbleness of a person in my station, Master Copperfield. Father and me was both brought up at a foundation school for boys, and Mother, she was likewise brought up at a public sort of charitable establishment. They taught us all a deal of humbleness. Not much else that I know of. From morning to night, we was to be humble to this person and humble to that, and to pull off our caps here and to make our bows there, and always to know our place and abase ourselves before our betters. And we had such a lot of betters. Father got the Monitor Medal by being humble. So did I. Father got made a sexton by being humble. He had the character among the gentlefolks of being such a well-behaved man that they were determined to bring him in. 'Be humble, Uriah,' says Father to me, 'and you'll get on.' It was what was always being dinned into you and me at school. 'It's what goes down best. Be humble,' says Father, 'and you'll do.' And really, it ain't done bad." It was the first time it had ever occurred to me that this detestable cant of false humility might have originated out of the Heap family. I'd seen the harvest, but had never thought of the seed. "When I was quite a young boy," said Uriah, "I got to know what humbleness did, and I took to it. I ate humble pie with an appetite. I stopped at the humble point of my learning, and says I, 'Hold hard. When you offered to teach me Latin, I knew better. People like to be above you,' says Father. 'Keep yourself down.' I'm very humble to the present moment, Master Copperfield, but I've got a little power." And he said all this. I knew, as I saw his face in the moonlight, that I might understand he was resolved to recompense himself by using his power. I had never doubted his meanness, his craft and malice, but I fully comprehended now, for the first time, what a base, unrelenting and revengeful spirit must have been engendered by this early and this long suppression. His account of himself was so far attended with an agreeable result, that it led to his withdrawing his hand in order that he might have another hug of himself under the chin. Once apart from him, I was determined to keep apart. And we walked back side by side, saying very little more by the way. Whether his spirits were elevated by the communication I'd made to him, or by his having indulged in this retrospect, I don't know, but they were raised by some influence. He talked more at dinner than was usual with him, asked his mother, off duty from the moment of our re-entering the house, whether he was not growing too old for a bachelor, and once looked at Agnes so that I would have given all I had for leave to knock him down.
This ends side 2 of cassette 18 of David Copperfield. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 19. Cassette 19.
When we three males were left alone after dinner, he got into a more adventurous state. He'd taken little or no wine, and I presume it was the mere insolence of triumph that was upon him, flushed perhaps by the temptation my presence furnished to its exhibition. I had observed yesterday that he tried to entice Mr. Wickfield to drink, and, interpreting the look which Agnes had given me as she went out, had limited myself to one glass, and then proposed that we should follow her. I would have done so again today, but Uriah was too quick for me. "We seldom see our present visitor, sir," he said, addressing Mr. Wickfield, sitting such a contrast to him at the opposite end of the table, "and I should propose to give him welcome in another glass or two of wine, if you have no objections. Mr. Copperfield, your health and happiness." I was obliged to make a show of taking the hand he stretched across to me, and then, with very different emotions, I took the hand of the broken gentleman, his partner. "Come, fellow partner," said Uriah, "if I may take the liberty. Now, suppose you give us something or another appropriate to Copperfield." I pass over Mr. Wickfield's proposing my aunt, his proposing Mr. Dick, his proposing Doctor's Commons, his proposing Uriah, his drinking, everything, twice.